Welcome to the Broadway Radio Show. I'm Donald Feltham, and we have a special guest. We have Ryan Donovan. Hi, Ryan.
Hi there.
Welcome to the show. And Ryan is here because he has written a book called Broadway Bodies, A Critical History of Conformity. And Ryan is also an assistant professor of theater studies at Duke University. I have to say, I finished the book just last week, and it's really an interesting book. It's very challenging because it kind of challenges your perceptions of Broadway and of theater. So why don't we talk a little bit about how the book came about? Because I know I want to dive into your background a little bit and your experiences when it came to casting as a 5'6" dancer, which we know is on the shorter end of the scale for Broadway shows.
Right. I actually am 5'5". I think that I opened the book by talking about how I lied about my height. And then I think I inadvertently did it again in the opening line of the book. But the book came about really because casting was the first way that I and many other people experienced theater. And that's in an educational context. So for me, it was elementary school, not getting the part that I just believed I was perfect for, even though I got the better part in the end, I see now. But that began the inquiry into casting for me. And when I was a dancer and I was performing in shows, I was in a production of Brigadoon in Summerstock in upstate New York. And one of my cast members was studying for her PhD in theater at the time. And she said to me that I should consider doing that. And she was maybe the second or third person to say that to me in my life, that I should get a PhD or, you know, a graduate degree at least. And I was dancing and I didn't, you know, I filed these things away and I didn't really think about them. And then as I was getting deeper into my career and kind of plateauing, I thought, what else do I want to do in my life that has meaning? And that's a little more rewarding than just going to chorus call after chorus call. And, you know, I looked back to childhood and the two things that I always used to do as a kid were play school and dance around the backyard. And so I went, you know, I kind of worked out the dancing around the backyard part. And then I thought, well, I can become an educator. And that, all of that really led me to write the book, which grew out of my my doctoral dissertation at the CUNY Graduate Center, and which I turned into the book over the course of the past 3 years. But it was about 4 years of research before that, plus a lifetime of experience in the industry in a way.
And it's really interesting. One of the things, it kind of brought me back because, as many of the listeners know, I started performing as a kid in children's theater, but then graduated into musical theater and expanded that whole bit. But then ultimately shifted because I just never really loved the competitive part of auditions and things, that I ended up going into the production side. So I sat on the casting side on the other side of the table many, many times. So reading your book was really kind of brought me back to some of those days of actually assisting in casting shows. And how one of the things that we were always adamant about, because we were doing it on more of a community theater, you know, equity guest contract type places, it was that we never typed people out. You know, we always brought people in no matter what we thought of how they looked, to let them get a chance to either do the movement audition or at least to come in and sing. We always gave everyone in a chance. But I know in professional theater, especially, you know, Broadway theater, it's not like that. And it's a lot of, because those casting calls are so massive, people get typed out. And what your book really tackles, and one of the things I loved about your book was that it was sort of like it was reading my mind, because as I was reading it, as something would pop into my brain, you would then immediately actually address what just popped into my brain, which was amazing to right through all the way to the end of the book. But talk about, the book is divided into sections, and it's divided into, there's a section at the beginning called Broadway Bodies. Then you tackle size, sexuality, ability, and then you have kind of an epilogue about going forward. But talk a little bit about let's talk a little bit about size, because you really do talk about people being typecast and how things really shifted. And sort of the marker seems to be in the book, seems to be a Chorus Line. Because as I was, it's funny because having you on the show, I was out to dinner with some friends who are theater. They're people who enjoy theater as an audience, as audience members. And I told you them you were coming on the show, and I told them a bit about the book, and I had to explain to them that in the golden age of Broadway musicals, you had a singing chorus and you had a dancing chorus. And the singers just were there to sing and the dancers were there to dance. And that's what they did. And so your singing chorus could look like anybody. I mean, they could be any body type. They could be any age, as long as they could sing. No one was required to act. And the dancers weren't required to sing. But then things started changing with the economics of Broadway. And you suddenly had Chorus Line thrusting this concept of the triple threat. You had to sing, dance, and act. And then you suddenly didn't have singing choruses anymore.
Yeah, that shift was really profound. And you know, the antecedents to a Chorus Line would be shows like Pippin from 72 and West Side Story from 57 and a few others. But the book begins with the Chorus Line because it's everything else that follows is actually in a Chorus Line. There's concerns about body type and size and casting. A Chorus Line was also really the first Broadway musical to be honest about its portrayal of gay people and the kind of adolescent experimentation that many of us do, and in terms of gender and sexuality and identity. And then it culminates in Paul's injury with concerns about disability in a way. I mean, I don't necessarily think that it's exactly disability, but it's analogous enough to that, you know, it raises the issue of what happens if you can't dance anymore because of an injury and that's your job. And in a sense that it's disabling. So the book begins with a Chorus Line for all of those reasons. And it's also just one of my very favorite shows. And like everything that's a favorite of mine, it's not an uncomplicated relationship. And I was interested in thinking about why do I feel this kind of ambivalence about aspects of a Chorus Line? And for me, it's mostly not about what happens on stage. I love that, but it's more about the way that the show needed to become replicable because it was such a hit. And then, you know, the kind of unintended consequences of its success, and how it made the dancers interchangeable in a way, but also at the same time, the original creative team really, their vision just kept getting redone over and over again. And the way that impacts casting is that, you know, at a certain point, there became a little bit of rigidity around who had to look a certain way to play a certain part, because they reminded the creative team of their castmates from the original production. And so as a dancer, I found that really kind of frustrating, because I don't look like anybody in the original production. And I really wanted to do a Chorus Line, and I never did.
But after a while, I caught on. I mean, I saw what they were hiring. I also swiped my dance card once after an audition, and on a scale of 10, they gave me, for dance, 10, for looks, 3. Well, dance, 10, looks, 3, and I'm still on unemployment, dance for my own enjoyment, that ain't it, kid, that ain't it, kid, dance, 10, looks, 3, it's like to die, left the theater and called the doctor for my appointment to buy tits and bought myself a fancy pair, tightened up the derriere, did the nose with it, all that goes with it, tits and ass, had the big gold bongos done, suddenly I'm getting national tours, tits and ass won't get you jobs unless they're yours. Didn't cost a fortune neither, didn't hurt my sex life either. I would get beggars really can't be choosers. That ain't it, kid. That ain't it, kid. Fix the chassis. How do you do? Life turned into an endless medley of gee, it had to be you. Why, tits and ass. Where the cupboard once was bare, now you're not and someone's there. You have got to pay top to bottom. Hey, it's a guess. Just a dash of silicone. Shake your new maracas and you're fine. Tits and ass can change your life. They sure. What you see, keep the best of you, do the rest of you, pits or class. I have never seen it fail, debutante or chorus girl, oh why? Tits and ass, yes, tits and ass have changed my life.
The show became a victim of its own success because it was such a breakthrough. And I love the fact that you really do go and do a real deep dive into A Chorus Line and the production history, and especially everything that's happening off stage. And as you said, with the, you know, the subsequent productions of all the different tours and the, you know, the sit down productions in different cities, it kind of was this double-edged sword. They broke so many boundaries with representing gay people and Puerto Rican people and all the, you know, all these different people on stage, and we're trying to get across this, the theme of the chorus people in a Broadway show are not just faceless, nameless bodies.
Right.
They're you're learning their individual stories, but then when they go to replicate the production, they get caught in their own trap. Because they only want to cast people who look just like the original people. So your Cassie always has to be white, and she always has to be a certain type, and your Paul always has to be a certain type, and they end up getting trapped in their own thing they were trying to break out of.
Yeah, and one of the things that was really exciting for me as I wrote the book was getting to interview people who were involved in various shows that I wrote about, and how their perspectives on it enriched my understanding and complicated it and challenged it. So for instance, you know, I mentioned I came into A Chorus Line with this idea that it was only a negative thing that they wanted to cast it with people that looked a certain way. But after interviewing Bjork Lee, who said, who was of course the original Connie in on Broadway and off Broadway, and then has restaged every major production of the show since 1975, and is just a true Broadway legend. Bjork's perspective is that she was paying homage to her A Chorus Line family by casting the show that way. And viewed in that light, I thought, well, that's actually so beautiful. It's mm-hmm. not just a negative thing. And also, you know, when you were talking earlier about sitting on one side of the audition table, for me, getting to talk to casting directors and hear their perspectives about the work that they do, that often goes really unseen by performers, was kind of reparative after having been a dancer and feeling like I, you know, was running up against casting directors, which was of course not really the case, but to get to hear their perspectives and what their goals are in casting was enormously fascinating. And in fact, I just had one of the casting directors that I interviewed for the book come to my class last week and talk to the students about what he's doing now. And he's moved into a different role now. But, you know, the work that casting directors do is so vitally important and often overlooked. Mm-hmm. So I loved getting to hear from them and to not just see them as gatekeepers, as I did as a younger performer.
That's the thing, is that it's really all about education and communication from every aspect, because the world of theater is such a creative area, but you always have these competing creative visions, and whether it's the performer, the director, the choreographer, the creative team who are designing the sets and costumes, the casting director, everyone has different ideas. And it's never, no pun intended, but it's never black and white.
Right.
It's just not. It's not black or white. It's there's so many gray areas that finding and it's amazing to me with all the, it's always been amazing to me that with all the things that are going on in people's heads, that a show actually gets up on its feet.
Totally. Well, that's what's so fascinating to me about musical theater is that there are so many gray areas, and so much of it is always going to be subjective. And I just think that all of there's so much to think about and so much to talk about and so much richness to dive into. And I love, for instance, I love teaching musical theater because I love when there's disagreement in class about what something means. Or I took students to see the tour of Jagged Little Pill, and they were really evenly split on it, whether they loved it or didn't like it. And it was really thrilling to hear them kind of hash it out and to think about what is this musical that's trying to speak to their generation saying, and how do they think of the ways that that show handles inclusion and casting. So it's so great to think through these things with young people as well.
Right. And you tackle Jagged Little Pill in the book. A little bit later on in the book, you talk a little bit later. Yeah. But let's talk about size, because that's the first main section, and specifically fat, and the fact that no one likes to use the word fat except except that it is an accepted term. And talk about, because you one of the way the book is laid out is you do talk about these different areas of, you know, conformity and Broadway bodies, but you do focus on some specific examples.
Yes,
you talk about Dreamgirls and kind of go really behind the scenes in the role of Effie, because Effie's not only fat, but she's a fat Black woman, which is, you know, so many different levels of issues there. But so talk a little bit about the what got you down the path with Dreamgirls, and then ultimately you end up with Hairspray. And
yeah, I started thinking about size and casting in grad school. And this was, I want to say that these chapters were the seed of the whole dissertation and the whole book in another sense. And I realized that, I think I began actually by writing about Hairspray. And I realized that it was one of the only leading roles in a musical that was regularly played by a fat actor and a fat woman. And I started thinking, well, what else, what other show could there be? And then, it, you know, the only other one in the period that I'm writing about from 1970 to today was Dreamgirls. And the more I dug into both of these shows and their histories, I found that there were a lot of troubling practices that happened off stage. And, you know, in both shows, they used fat suits or padding, as costume designers might call them, more politely. And the interesting thing about those shows is that, you know, there are these two roles and only a white woman or a Black woman could play them in a major production. And so, you know, that leaves a lot of other people out from consideration, even because both of these shows are about race relations in the US, and particularly Black and white race relations. So I love both of these shows, and I couldn't stop thinking about the bind that performers got placed in when they were cast in one of these parts. So for instance, the young women who played Tracy Turnblad were all weighed in regularly at the same time that they were being told to exercise, and they had to maintain a certain weight, which means they had to eat a certain amount, but then also spend a certain amount of time on the treadmill. And then it's all kind of moot because they're wearing a fat suit anyway.
Right.
So, you know, like that was so compelling to me and troubling. And then looking back at Dreamgirls,
that was even more troubling to me. The whole Dreamgirls thing was shocking to me. I did not know a lot of that stuff was going on.
Yeah. And part of why I was so compelled to keep to do a whole chapter about Dreamgirls was that the production changed its narrative about Effie's size after Jennifer Holliday left and had started missing performances because of vocal strain, among other things. I mean, this is Effie is probably the biggest sing in musical theater, maybe even I think vocally it's probably the hardest role for a belter. It's so relentless, and you have all of these really demanding songs to sing, and you know, nobody gave 19-year-old 20-year-old Jennifer Holliday the grace to say, we're going to give you a matinee, Effie, you know?
Right.
But, you know, the way that the production just kind of turned their backs on her was so troubling, in addition to the way that the press just openly wrote about Holliday's body with such scorn. Mm-hmm. And so that, I mean, for me, that's what's so fascinating too, is to look at how our norms have changed in the decades since 1981 when Dreamgirls opened, and that we wouldn't accept that kind of language anymore, but it was so commonplace.
Yeah. And you give shocking examples. I mean, you pull out the quotes and put them in the book so you can see them for yourself. And then I was just in terms of Dreamgirls, I was absolutely floored by the production team and even subsequent Effie's basically saying, oh, well, Effie doesn't have to be fat. Like, there's nothing in the script that says she's fat. There's nothing in the character breakdown that says she's fat. Although you go back and disprove that.
But,
but then you have future actresses who are not necessarily skinny, but they're not as, you know, they're not as heavy as Jennifer Holliday was. Right. And they're all claiming, oh, well, there's nothing that says Effie has to be fat, but they're wearing padding. Effie is supposed to be fat if the actresses are wearing padding on stage.
Or they're saying, why are you calling me in for that role?
Right.
I'm not fat. I mean, there is also the argument that Effie is secretly pregnant at the end of Act One. But, you know, it's never specified that she's 9 months pregnant. She could have been 1 month pregnant.
Right.
Like we really have no idea. But I was so obsessed almost by the way that what happens to Effie on stage in that show is exactly what happened to Jennifer Holliday off stage. Mm-hmm. And I find her to be a very moving figure. She's almost like Liza Minnelli, like in that she just perseveres. She keeps going and she's always putting herself out there very vulnerably. If you follow her on Instagram or anything, I mean, she's still singing the Dreamgirls songs anywhere that will have her. I think she was just on Tamron Hall's show last week singing And I Am Telling You. And, and it's fascinating too that this was kind of a role that she tried to shed her association with, but it's one that you can see that she's eventually come around to accept and see as a positive thing.
Yeah, she's definitely turned it into a positive for her. By kind of accepting that she's the most identified with the role. And also, I think, kind of coming to terms with everything she went through and growing from that and learning more about herself.
Look at me. Look at me. I am changing. Trying every way I can, I am changing. I'll be better than I am. I'm trying to find a way to understand, but I need you. Everything is so clear. I am changing. I'm gonna stop right now, right here. I'm hoping to work it out, and I know that I can. But I need you.
be better than I am. But I need a friend to help me start all over again. Oh, that would be just fine. I know it's gonna work out this time, 'cause this time I am. This time I am changing. I'll get my life together now.
Talk about the changes, though, because there have been changes over the years, especially more recently with the depiction of or the casting of fat performers, because it has changed. I mean, I'm a regular, I live in Los Angeles, but I go to New York all the time. And I have been so happy to see, to actually go to shows where I am seeing performers of different sizes playing principal roles, and they are not playing a character that is specifically fat.
Yeah, that's really exciting. I mean, I think this season, Bonnie Milligan's role in Kimberly Akimbo.
There's nothing that says that she should be fat.
Right. And also her role in Head Over Heels similarly said nothing about the character's appearance. And other than that, she was the most beautiful princess in the kingdom.
Yeah.
So, I think this is so exciting. And I also think we can see that there's changes happening in the composition of ensembles, in that you're starting to see ensembles where there are people of all shapes and sizes, in addition to other kinds of visible difference. So I think it's really exciting that all of this is finally happening. I think there could still be more,
right?
But it's exciting that we're just at this point right now, and that we're having a start of the conversation.
Exactly. And it's also nice, because I know from people I talk to who go to theater regularly, they're liking it too, because they know, very few people I know have the physique of a dancer, and they love the fact that they can go see a show and they see people in the chorus or ensemble, or sometimes leads, who look like them. They're not perfectly, they're not going to the gym every single day. They're not thin as a stick, and they're dancing, and they're out there, performing just as well as everybody else on stage. And it just gives people in the audience a better connection with the show. And they think to themselves, oh my God, I could do that. I could actually get up on stage and perform.
Right. Yeah. And that's exciting. And I think, I want to make clear to people, though, that I still think creative teams should be allowed to cast whoever they want and have creative license. Mm-hmm. I think that audiences now, you're absolutely right, are coming in with the expectation that theater is going to be inclusive, and it's going to represent more of what the real world looks like in terms of who's populating the stage, right?
Right.
So I think that's exciting. I still think there should be a place for the show with the dancer bodies. Let's not throw that out entirely, but let's also not, try to be rigid about things one way or the other. So,
right. Well, it's really, the first step is just getting rid of the typing out of people.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. One of the things that as an actor, typing is your friend and your foe.
Yeah.
It's terrible when you get typed out on the one hand, on the other, on a practical level, you're like, okay, great. They're not wasting my time. I can go about my day now. Mm-hmm. So there's, you know, there's that aspect of it too. And a lot of actors, including some of the ones I quoted in the section on size, talked about how typing was actually their, they turned it into a positive for their career. And, you know, so I mean, like everything, it's not
everything's a gray area, right? Yeah. It's all a gray area. It just is. Yeah. But that's one of the best things about your book is that as you are reading it, it's challenging your perceptions. It's challenging everything you think about theater on some level. But at the same time, it's also because you are very even-handed in how you talk about things and you give perspectives, not only your perspective, but also the perspective of, as you said, casting directors and performers. And you see that it's not an easy solution. There's no easy solution here.
Exactly.
There isn't. And I, you know, to move on to the next section, you talk about sexuality and you go very deep dive into La Cage aux Folles because it's one of those shows that was so groundbreaking in the sense that, and I was thrilled that you actually pointed out that it was not the first Broadway musical to show a gay relationship on stage.
Yes.
Even though everybody claims it was the first show that, you know, you had a gay couple singing a love song, a love duet, which is not true.
It was just the first hit.
Yeah. Because it was beat by Dance a Little Closer, which opened a few months earlier and had a gay couple.
And you can actually see that, the number from Dance a Little Closer on YouTube.
Skating number.
Yeah.
Why can't the world leave us alone? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And it's a wonderful number. Unfortunately, the show only lasted one performance, but it did beat La Cage. But it's really fascinating to read the whole section on La Cage because you talk about it's so, you know, groundbreaking. And yet the two lead actors who were playing the gay couple were straight. And there was never any kind of thought that, well, maybe we should purposely cast two gay actors to play the and you didn't really even until you got to the first revival that you actually had gay actors playing the roles.
Right. And, you know, in 1983, they would have been hard pressed to find any out gay actors. So that has to be part of the consideration there too. And, you know, I was actually reading something that was about this conversation about who should play whom you know, I'm less interested in who should play gay roles, I guess, than in who did. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what were the implications of that and the ramifications? And La Cage is just because it ran so long and had such an impact, it's such a rewarding show to think about. And the fact that it keeps coming back, I think, speaks to something really deep about its power and how moving it is and how complicated it is, because, you know, it's never been universally beloved. And I think early on, you know, the gay press tended to really like it. And I think there's still a lot of affection in what's left of like gay media for this show. But, you know, even there's, you know, there was no kind of agreement other than that, like, actually most straight critics thought the show wasn't gay enough or, you know, held back, but which is fascinating, you know.
Absolutely.
God bless Frank Rich for that.
Right, exactly. One of the few things you can thank Frank Rich for.
That windy little beach we walked along that afternoon in fall, that afternoon we met a fellow with a concertina sang. What was the song? It's strange what we recall and odd what we forget. I heard la da 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 as we walked on. on the sand. I heard la-da-da-da, I believe it was early September. Through the crash of the waves, I could tell that the words were romantic. Something about sharing, something about always. Though the years race along, I still think of our song on the sand. And I still try and search for the words I can barely remember. Though the time tumbles by, there is one thing that I am forever certain of. I hear la da 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 da, and I'm young and in love. I believe it was early September. Through the crash of the waves, I could tell that the words were romantic. Something about sharing, something about always. Though the years race along, I still think of our song on the sand. And I still try and search for the words I can barely remember. Though the time tumbles by, there is one thing that I am forever certain of. I hear la da 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 da, and I'm young.
That whole section of the book also talks about the kind of the dearth of lesbian relationships
and lesbian characters
and lesbian characters, which I, you know, you kind of forget about a little bit. I hate to say that, but you just kind of forget about it because we're so used to having a Lacage or a Falsettos, or, you know, we're used to having gay men represented, but lesbians, only until recently do they really get to be center stage in a show. I mean, it's really, you know, Fun Home, and then you have The Prom, and you finally start to get the increase in lesbian representation in musicals.
Yeah. Lesbian invisibility is such a huge cultural problem that it's no surprise that musicals also reflect that. Mm-hmm. And as you say, that's being corrected in the shows you mentioned, and even Head Over Heels. But right. It's, and Rent, you know, there's the odd example. And I mean, luckily Fun Home is just such a staggeringly brilliant show that it kind of makes up a little bit for the lack. I'm in Durham, North Carolina by the train track. So you're going to hear the Amtrak.
Oh, I think I heard a train whistle. I heard a whistle go by just a second ago.
That's if listeners are like, why is there a train in the background?
That's okay.
It takes a long time to go by. I think it's almost finished. But yeah, there are so few lesbian characters in musical theater. And, mm-hmm. you know, one of the, I think, odd things about this is that even in a show like Falsettos, which was one of the first to feature a lesbian couple, they don't even have names on stage. They're just the lesbians next door. they do have names in the playbill, so you can see there, but then, you know, they're never referred to by name. And, you know, that's kind of in telling, I think, of Broadway's relationship to that point with representing lesbian characters.
I wanted to go back real quick and just, I wanted to quote your dedication in the book,
because
the dedication really is sort of gives you an idea of what the book is really about. So, because you say the book is dedicated to anyone who has ever been told they were too fat, too short, too gay, too disabled, and otherwise too much or not enough to be in a musical. And, you know, you, in all these sections where you're covering, one of the things that's interesting, of course, with sexuality is being told you are too gay is not necessarily something that you can change. I mean, it's something you can change in your auditions, which you can't do if you're disabled or you are fat or whatever.
Right.
You can, because I have had many, you know, actor friends tell me that, you know, they've been told, oh, you need to butch it up when you go to this audition. You need to not be so gay. And it's sort of like, well, what exactly are the parameters for what is too gay? What is not gay? What is too heterosexual? What is, I mean, it's a very weird area.
Yeah. I mean, has anyone ever been told they were too heterosexual?
Right.
I guess it's the question that I would, you know, flip that around to say, so ask any gay actor and of a certain generation, maybe, you know, older millennials and above, and they will probably all tell you something horrible that's been said to them by a teacher, a casting director, an agent, a director. You know, it's such a common experience. And yeah, even one of my friends who's a director now told me as I was working on the book, the story about when he was in college and studying musical theater and he would get up to do his song, the professor would say to one of the classmates, okay, now get out the masculinity meter because we're going to rate so-and-so's performance on how masculine it is. And it's like, you can't believe that that kind of thing happened nowadays. You know, it's hard for young people to imagine, I think, unless they're in a horrible institution where that happens. But, you know, that was the norm. That was the kind of price of admission for gay men.
Yeah.
And certainly it's different for lesbians and everybody else under the LGBTQ plus umbrella faces their own challenges of navigating the industry and the kind of way that you are expected to present in an audition space. And I don't know, you know, I haven't been a performer for a while now that I'm a scholar. And so I'm not sure how it's happening in rooms now. Actually, it's mostly happening on self tapes. So,
yeah.
You know, the physical presence, I think, is so, it's so vital for live theater that I can't imagine that the industry is still relying on self tapes, which I'm sure opens an entirely different Pandora's box.
I've heard recently that it's getting back to more in the room. They're starting to shift back to that. Although self tapes are still happening, especially for television and movies and things like that. The self tapes are happening, but I've heard that the in-person auditions are starting to happen again in New York. So
yeah, bit by bit, I think they're coming back.
And I think that in this whole area of just, you know, gender representation and things have, you know, really started to change. I mean, Alex Newell's in a big Broadway show right now that's about to open. And, you know, you're starting to see that it's just, things have just started to change. And I'm not sure, I guess audiences are more accepting. It's so strange because, as you said, you've got this generation of young performers who are much different in terms of their gender identification and their sexual orientation, and all those different issues is totally different, and they are bumping up against the old guard Broadway producers and directors and things who are from a different generation, let's admit.
Yeah,
I mean, they're from a different generation and they see things differently. And you're sort of I'm not from, you know, the conversations I've had with friends in New York, there is some pushback on both sides, but I think people are finding that people are trying to find happy compromises that are working for everyone, which is nice to hear, because it's, you know, as you know, because you've been in theater, theater is just one, it's one big family. Every show you're in is one big family, regardless of age, gender, anything, anybody you're working with. It's just a big family. And you always have disagreements. There's people in the family you don't like that you figure out a way to get along with. And there's people who you become lifelong friends with in your family. And it's all, but it's all a collaborative world.
Yeah. You know? It's such a small industry.
Yes.
That, you know, I'm always, and I no longer consider myself part of it because I'm an academic now, and I love being an academic, and I love being an observer of the industry, but not a participant. And it's fascinating to me to see this generational divide around a lot of these issues, and the way that some people will break the unspoken rules of the industry and take to social media to call out other shows, which is, you know, I like being an observer of the industry because I don't feel the pressure to be a cheerleader in the way that you do when you're in it. And it's surprising to me still when, you know, a younger person will break those rules to call out, for instance, you know, one of the performers in Anne Juliet is calling out Some Like It Hot's representation of its non-binary character. You know, and I think a lot of these shows are feeling a lot of pressure because they are firsts. And there's a lot of pressure to quote unquote get it right when you are doing something for one of the first few times on Broadway. And I always remind my students that what's right for me may not be right for you, and vice versa. And when it comes to representation, there's no such thing as getting it right. You cannot create art to please everybody, or to, you know, to represent an entire group. It's not possible, and it's not fair to the art or the artists putting that, bringing that to life on stage every night, to feel that, you know, the burden of representing an entire group, it's too much to carry. I think that this generational divide is really real and interesting and challenging for both sides, who I think could learn from each other, perhaps rather than you know, take to social media. And
I agree. I see some of those little skirmishes that happen on social media also, and I kind of shake my head and smile and go, it's part of the business, and it's like you said, you cannot create art, especially in theater, that's going to satisfy everyone. It just doesn't. That's the joy of theater and why we want to have more theater, because it some pieces appeal to a certain audience and some pieces appeal to a different audience, and you are seeing the creative expression of the writers and the performers and the director. And their creative expression may not line up with how you would creatively express it, but you're also not working on that particular show. You know, it's all, but it's also part of the joy of theater, is that you do have these things that pop up that, at least as long as it's encouraging civil conversations about it. And that's really what helps, is people having conversations about it that are informed and civil.
Yeah, and we can really do that in person much more effectively and with much more empathy than most people are able to do on Twitter, for instance.
Right, exactly. I tell people all the time, please don't remember that texts and posts and things do not carry emotional content. I mean, they don't capture the intent necessarily, or the tone, and it can't be misread. So
yeah.
And
it's actually fun to disagree about theater in person with somebody, because you might learn something and they might change your mind, or vice versa. And you know, to see a show through someone else's eyes is enormously revealing and exciting. You know, especially if you saw it together and you had wildly different experiences.
Great. And that's one of the things that your book does, which is one of the reasons I really love the book so much, is that
thank you.
It's a kind of book that you you should read and talk to people about, talk to your friends about, or encourage them to read it, because it will bring up interesting, challenging conversations. Because there are going to be people who are going to read your book who are not going to agree with everything you said in the book. And it's only because they're seeing things from a totally different perspective. But you, I think you do such a great job of presenting as many different sides of these issues as you can to help the reader. Maybe not, you don't want to, I never get the impression you're preaching to the reader. You're basically providing them with different viewpoints and hoping, I think, that the reader will read all these and think about it and come up with their, what, how they really feel about this and discuss it with other people.
Absolutely. The book is really an invitation for people to question the accepted norms of Broadway casting, mm-hmm. and really to think about one way into that invitation is to imagine if things were different and I didn't feel the need to write this book. So for instance, what if it was the norm that non-disabled characters on Broadway were played by actors with disabilities? What if it was totally accepted that fat people could play any part they wanted on Broadway, not just a few that are typically cast with them or the comic sidekick? What if we had a fat Cinderella or a fat leads in the Bridges of Madison County, for instance? It's a little bit more of a gray area with sexuality, because especially nowadays with the ongoing kind of revolution in gender and sexuality that we're experiencing in the country. And I'm really interested currently in the kind of flexibility that we all demand off stage, and how that's in a great amount of tension with the rigidity that we demand in casting on stage. Mm-hmm. And, I think that's kind of a conundrum to think about, but, how can we kind of meet in the middle of these two competing demands of flexibility and rigidity? And that pretty much comes up only in terms of gender and sexuality, but that's also our moment. If we zoom out, we can see that, the pendulum's always swinging and things are always changing.
Yeah.
So the book's also an invitation to recognize that and not feel stuck or powerless to change things, because I think what I'm showing in the book is that, there are these long histories that are troubling in many cases, but not only troubling. Sometimes they're hopeful. Sometimes there are breakthroughs, and it's not I hope it's not a bleak reading experience by the end, which
no.
is why the epilogue is hopeful about the change.
Yeah.
And really poses a question, about will Broadway change? And, the book ends in 2020. So it's been exciting to see that when Broadway came back, after the pandemic shut down, that things did change.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not wholesale enough for everybody, but
That's not how change happens.
Right. Yeah.
It happens in increments. It just does.
Absolutely. And, it's visible now on Broadway,
yeah.
not just in who we see on stage, but whose works are getting produced. And, the success of shows like A Strange Loop and Fat Ham, in particular, speak to what I write about in the book. And, they both won Pulitzer Prizes and are fantastic. So I'm actually hopeful that the book is going to be more of a historical document of past practices than, people often ask me, what should we do? And to challenge the things you write about. And I'm like, well, the book, it's not really a how-to, it's almost a how not to. I think we can look at, what's happening now. It's not just the shows I've mentioned that are doing this well right now. I mean, Camelot has a disabled actor playing one of the major supporting roles. And
mm-hmm.
I think A Doll's House also right now, too, is inclusively cast. And so really the upside for Broadway of the pandemic is that there was a pause to really reckon with its mm-hmm. past practices. And, you know, you're right, the change is incremental, but that doesn't mean we still shouldn't celebrate it. So,
absolutely.
I don't think you meant that, but I think it's so important to acknowledge and applaud the change, because everybody loves positive reinforcement, even Broadway producers.
Oh, they love. And that's you know, that kind of brings me to a point that I really wanted to talk about, which was by the end of the book, you know, it's really important that these conversations are happening behind the scenes, you know, on Broadway. But it's also important that these conversations are happening with audience members, and audience members, especially not necessarily just in New York on Broadway, but audience members who are subscribers to theater companies all over the country should be reading this book and having conversations with the theaters that they subscribe to, because the conversation has to not only be backstage and in the production offices, but it also needs to be with the audiences. And, you know, audiences need to have their voices heard and communicate with the producers of their shows, saying, this is what we want to see on stage. This is, you know, our thoughts on this.
Right. And audiences can, if they don't feel comfortable speaking directly to the theater staff, they can speak with their wallet and not go see shows that don't interest them or don't seem to reflect the world offstage and all of its variety.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really important way that people can make their voices heard too.
And looping back to one of the comments I made at the beginning, where I felt like this book was reading my mind as I was reading it. When I got to the epilogue, I said, "Oh gosh, I really, really hope that he's going to mention the only theater production of Beauty and the Beast by Marshall Milgram Dodge, because that to me was such a wonderful moment that this show got produced and got the press coverage it got and the positive press coverage it got." And so talk a little bit about that production for people who don't know about it. And, you know, talk about Evan Ruggiero and Jay Jones and their casting in this. It's a major production. The only theater is a big theater.
Yeah, I went to see it, actually.
Oh, did you see it?
Yeah, and it was fantastic. I mean, you know, sometimes you never know what the production of values are going to be like at a regional theater, and this exceeded my expectations. Mm-hmm. The set, everything was just, you know, so good. The cast was phenomenal, and the reason this production attracted so much national media attention was because it was cast with Jade Jones as Belle. And Jade, I think one of the quotes in People magazines maybe says that Jade is a plus size queer Black woman. So, you know, many of those identity characteristics would never be considered for Belle, you know, before this. And although, you know, Black women have played Belle before, I believe Toni Braxton played Belle on Broadway. Yeah. But, you know, forget about plus size and queer. Playing Belle, openly queer anyway. And then Evan Ruggiero as the Beast. Evan was, I believe, in college when he had one of his legs amputated, and he's a phenomenal tap dancer. You can see his amazing tap dancing videos on Instagram and YouTube. But he played the Beast, and so, you know, they had these two actors playing these romantic leads in this fairy tale musical that is, you know, it was so powerful, and audiences really just went with it right away. Of course, you see who's playing the roles, and then you think, well, that's what Belle looks like in this production, and that's what the Beast looks like. And, you know, there's so much talk about how representation matters and that people need to see themselves on stage, and of course I think that's so important, but I want to offer that what was so important about this particular production is, yes, that it spoke to kids who look like Jade and Evan, but it's not just speaking to them, it's speaking to every child in the room about who belongs on stage, and I think that's as powerful as almost more powerful than seeing yourself, is getting to see people who never get to play these parts in these roles. And if you're a kid seeing that, you're going to grow up with that as an idea of what happens. It's not going to seem outrageous to you or shocking or surprising. It's going to seem like that's the way it should be. And I think that's what's so fantastic about their casting. And, you know, kudos to Marsha Milgram Dodge for thinking outside of the typical bodies that could play those parts. And it was really, really just so, so great to see it. And, you know, as I was finishing the book, that's when that production went up for the first time. And I thought, oh my gosh, I have to get there to see this because this is everything I wrote about embodied on stage. And, you know, the hope is that Broadway will take notice of that kind of casting.
I would, to be honest with you, first off, it's the perfect show anyway, because what's the whole theme of the love story in the show is to see beneath people's exteriors,
right?
See who they really are and to see their inner beauty, no pun intended, but that's what the show is. And I would, you know, I think I read that they're doing it again. They're going to be doing it. Olney's going to be doing it again with the same cast. And I got to say, if Disney was smart, they would transfer this show to New York. They just would.
Yeah. It's,
think of the incredible positive press and impact this show could have by playing on a New York stage.
Yeah.
And if people are not familiar with it, there are clips up from the show on YouTube that you can catch. And you will see Jade Jones is a wonderful Belle. She just is.
Really, really wonderful.
She really is. You know, yeah. She's got a gorgeous singing voice and so much heart in her performance that it doesn't matter what Belle looks like.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, and this is what's interesting too, is that, you know, when we look, when we stop looking only at what somebody looks like, we can start to see the other qualities of their humanity that they bring with them on stage. And that's really what you took away from these actors' performances and the whole production.
Right.
It was really great.
And that's also what you get from your book is
you
really learn that, you know, Broadway casting has fallen into this trap over the years and it's time for change. And it's time for us to kind of reevaluate what we expect to see on stage in shows and how important it is. So congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much.
I'm glad you were able to take some time to chat. And I encourage people, I will make sure that there's a link here on the website, excuse me, so people can get out there and purchase their copy of Broadway Bodies by Ryan Donovan. And hope to see you again really soon.
Thank you.